Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Break, the podcast bringing content to sports fans at a time when we are deprived of live action. My guest today is the second youngest snooker champion of all time and went on to become one of only a handful of Triple Crown winners. I am, of course, talking about the wonderful magician, Sean Murphy. Sean, hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Andy?
I'm good, very well. How are you enjoying lockdown at the moment?
Yeah, I think enjoying's a stretch, isn't it? But just we're all in this situation together, aren't we? That's the thing, I think. It's the same for everyone, and you just got to get through it the best you can and keep watching those updates and staying safe, like trying to stay out of everyone's way.
Well, listen, I'll ask you the question I'm asking all the other snooker players I'm lucky enough to talk to. How are you practicing? Are you practicing? What are you doing with snooker at the moment?
No, I haven't hit a ball since probably getting on for a month or so now, since the Tour Champs where I was practicing there. I just got into this, getting ready for my game there against Mark Allen, got the call to say the tournament was postponed, and I haven't hit a ball since. I've no access to a table here. I don't have a table at home anymore like we did in the UK. I play at the Stevens Green Club in Dublin, city centre. And so, even if I wanted to go in, the place is closed. But sure, we've got nothing to practice for anyway. So it's a very, very strange time, isn't it, for all of us? Very, very strange times.
Does that worry you that you haven't hit a ball for 4 weeks and it's going to be longer? What's the longest you've gone previously without playing snooker?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure, but this will be it, I would say, when we do eventually come out of this period. This will be the longest. It reminds me of the old days when you used to have like nearly 3 months off after the World Champs, you know, when we only had 6-7 tournaments, and you'd come away from your summer break, and those first couple of days practicing in the club were quite funny, like you could lose to anyone and miss anything. So I'm sure it'll be a bit like that, but hopefully it won't take too long to get back into the swing of things.
No. Well, listen, I've got you for half an hour. We're going to talk about all your career and all your ups and downs. And of course, that time you became world champion, the second youngest one ever. But before we talk about your career as a professional, I want to talk about you as a kid growing up. Were you always going to be a snooker player? Did you always have that talent as a young kid?
I took to it straight away. Like, I had no interest in it whatsoever. And, you know, until Santa brought me a table, like, you know, I didn't have any... We didn't know what the game was until I saw the table. But once I connected with it, once I sort of started understanding it, then it just took over mine and, yeah, everyone in the family's life. You know, it became that was it. And it was practice every day. It was the club each night after school, all sorts. It just became that was what our life was about, like, you know.
What age are you talking? And also, did you excel straight away? Were you a natural or did you have to work at it?
I got the table for Christmas, a little 6-footer. There's a picture somewhere in my mum's scrapbook from the Boxing Day the day after, where I actually look like a little snooker player, and I've obviously been playing a day. You know, my elbow was in the right place, my bridge was in the right place, and you just think, like, what was that about? But I think it wasn't that long after that I made a 50-something break on that little table, and apparently my dad went downstairs and said to my mum, like, this is weird, you know, that's not normal, that. And then we very quickly progressed on to sort of proper full-size tables. I heard that Ronnie had made his first century when he was 10, and I said, right, I'd love to try and do that myself. And 2 weeks after turning 10, I made a 1-2-7 against him in the club.
Wow.
Just peering over the edge of the table, like, you know. But I think that was probably why I turned out to be a decent rest player, you know, when I was that age. You know, every other shot was with the rest.
And as a kid growing up, who were your heroes in the snooker world?
Yeah, I mean, I watched everything. Like, if I could find a TV free or videos at car boot sales or whatever it was, you know, I watched it all. But I think out of them all, you know, Davis was the one who I sort of looked to as my, yeah, I'd love to, if I could do a, you know, a tenth of what you've achieved, I'd consider that to be, you know, a good career. Like, you know.
Away from snooker just for a moment, but still sticking with you as a kid, you had quite a difficult upbringing, didn't you? What was home life like for you growing up?
Yeah, it was tough. I think there's a big misconception that I come from a, you know, very well-to-do, sort of well-off background and had everything my own way, you know, and that's completely wrong. You know, my parents did separate in my mid-teens, but before that, you know, we'd gone through some turbulent times as a family financially. You know, life from being sort of 8 years of age was car boot sales on a Sunday, auction things on a Thursday, trying to nick a few quid here or there. I was playing in snooker tournaments and we were using that cash to, you know, trying to just keep everything afloat. Things were very, very difficult for us as a family. But, you know, the sort of me, my mum and my dad, even though I was a child, you know, we were all in it together, really. And later on, you know, we sort of progressed. We got out of that sort of mess, if you like. And the big change for us came when I was 12. And Doc Martens, who were a local company, they were based, obviously a worldwide company, but they were based in the town next to where I lived. They supported a lot of local sports people and Rushden Diamonds Football Club. And they said, oh, we'd really like to try and support you. And but for their support, which lasted 3 or 4 years, I just wouldn't be sat here talking to you today. You know, there was lots of help along the way, hour after hour in clubs and traveling the country. But if it hadn't have been for Max Griggs, who was the sort of patriarch of that company, if he hadn't have stepped in and said, we'd like to help, just wouldn't be sat here. Wouldn't have happened.
So did you see snooker as a bit of an escape for you from your home life?
Yeah, without question. Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we got to the club, everything else in life sort of fell away, and any troubles we had, any difficulties we had, they just vanished, and they were replaced with snooker trouble. You know, why couldn't I make it? You know, why putting the white in the right play and all of that stuff? But it was definitely escapism. And you know, while I was sat in school, I would be sat there imagining breaks and looking at the board and working out how I could pop that word into that pocket and all this. You know, I just had no interest at school. And that was obviously then shown. I left school at 13. I never went back after year 9. That was me done.
So when you left school, were you always going to be a snooker player? Because I've spoken to you many a time about this. You told me a great story about how, and we'll get to the World Championship in a minute, but how that was basically your last chance saloon, if you like. If you didn't qualify, you were going to give up snooker and go down a different avenue. But when you left school at that tender age, were you at that moment, were you always going to be a snooker player, or did you have other ideas of where you were going to end up?
That was it. There was no safety net. There was no second ideas. There was, I actually remember, what do they call it now, where like a careers officer comes into school and you have that day where you go to the, you know, someone's office and, you know, they say, now, what would you like to be when you leave school? How do you see this planning with your GCSEs and you sat and this, that and the other? And I just looked at this woman and I said, no, I'm going to be a snooker player. And she said, yeah, but I know that. But, you know, what about this? That? And I said, no, you don't understand. I said, all I'm interested in doing is being a snooker. Anyway, she called for the head of PE, was a guy called Mr. Perkins. And he and I got on really well. And she said, listen, I'm having a bit of trouble with this one. Like, you know, I can't get through to him. And he said, yeah, no, he's interested in his snooker. We've tried to sell him as well. And that was that. And I actually saw this guy, Mr. Perkins, just a few months after winning the Worlds in 05. And we met in the pub and we had a few beers. It was good times.
I had the same conversation with my careers advisor. Genuinely, I said snooker player. And they laughed at me like they laughed at you. But look at me now. I'm always there on finals day.
You're more consistent than me.
So listen, when you turned pro, how old were you? What was your game like as an amateur? Were you a top amateur? And was it just a matter of time before you turned pro then?
Yeah, my amateur career was a funny one because it didn't really happen. I played on the juniors I was in the, you know, any junior event or any pro event that was happening, I was in it. And then when I was 15, I turned pro. And I think what WPBSA have made two exceptions for people in the past, because you were supposed to be 16. I think myself and Ronnie have had that dispensation given to us. And I actually have never got to the bottom of how and why that was given, because of tobacco sponsorship, you had to be 16 to be on the tour.
Yeah.
And never actually got to the bottom of why I was allowed on the tour before I was 16. I remember celebrating my 16th birthday at Plymouth Pavilions, and all the ushers had got me a cake, and it was just before or just after a game, like, you know. So I remember that. But I don't really know why I was allowed to get through that. You know, it certainly wasn't anything I didn't have anything to do with it. We applied to be allowed to join the tour, and that was that. Not really sure.
And things didn't go too smoothly for you to begin with. You turned pro in 98, but am I right in saying you fell off the tour to begin with?
I did. I had a year on the tour and dropped straight off. And it didn't help, in fairness to me, that the WP, they changed the qualifying criteria for the following season halfway through that year. And it went from something like, you know, the top 196 will retain their tour place to, I think it was the top 106 or 96. So basically, like, there was 100 of us who were in. And then all of a sudden we weren't. It was just kind of, you know, get on with it, like. And yeah, there was almost no way, once they made that choice, that myself and, as I say, the other lads could possibly stay on the tour. It was almost mathematically impossible unless you'd won an event or something, which, you know, I didn't. And yeah, I dropped back to what was called the UK tour, which would now be like a challenge tour. I dropped back to that for two or three seasons. It was very difficult watching all the lads that I'd played with as a young junior, as a, you know, a young kid. A lot of them got through and turned pro the year after. You, Mark Selvidge, Stephen Maguire's, Ryan Day, they sort of sailed off into the distance, and I was left there on the challenge tour going, what, how's this, and yeah, have I ended up here, like, you know.
And you obviously had doubts about whether or not you're going to make it to the very top, because, you know, you turn pro at a very young age, you then fall off the tour, and then when you come back on, as I mentioned at the top of our chat, it's a great story, and I'm going to ask you to tell it now about how you thought, you know, qualifying for the World Championships in the year you ironically went on to win it in 2005. You thought, right, if it doesn't happen now, I need a complete career change.
I think it all stems back to this story, stems back to just how I was brought up, and sort of, it's why I don't like the word consistency that much, is because I was trained and taught to only try to win. And if you didn't win, it was failure. Now, I, as a parent myself now, I get that that's a bit black and white, and the world doesn't work like that. But that's how I was taught. And when I did eventually get back on the tour in 2001, something like that, I spent the next 3 or 4 years waiting for my sort of, when's the win going to come? Like, you know, and not only did it not come, I found it hard to climb the rankings. I wasn't really climbing. Of course, the rankings were different back then. You went up in groups of 16 once a year. So it was quite hard to make any progress. Now, the season we're talking about, in 04-05, I was working with Steve Prest, who's sadly no longer with us. And we were working so hard, you know, 3-4 times a week, driving hundreds of miles to see each other, practicing for 10-11 hours a day. And we were going to all the matches in the qualifiers and just not getting anywhere. And I had a really bad beat in the China Open qualifier. I think I can never remember. It was either Rob Milkins or it was Gerard Green. And I can't remember who it was. And at 4 each, I had whoever the player was snookered on 3 reds. And I was sort of 45 ahead or something. And whoever it was fluked a red and dished. And on the way home, I said to Steve, that's it. I'm done. Like, I can't do this anymore. And we didn't speak all the way home. And later that night, I confirmed it. I said to him, that's, you know, I'm finished with this game. I'm just not. It hasn't worked out. Tried my best, really tried, did everything that was asked of me, left school, practiced hard every single day, you know, sacrificed a lot of friendships, this, that, and the other, moved across the country. But it just hasn't worked. It doesn't work for everyone, and it hasn't worked for me. And he said, well, listen, you've paid your entry fee, enter the tournament, play it, don't waste the 700 quid, and see what happens. And I wasn't for it. I was like, nah, Steve, no, I'm not bothering. And I actually went to the Mercedes dealership in Sheffield, where I lived at the time, and went and got a job. And the MD of the place was like, well, listen, you know, play this, do this snooker thing. And as and when it doesn't work.
As what? A car salesman?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I know.
Right. Yeah.
I know. And he was like, you know, well, you've got the job. I think you'd be good at the job, blah, blah, blah. I know you're keen on this snooker rubbish. I think that's what you should, you know, get this snooker out of the way. You know, we'll see you when we see you, like, you know, you come in, sort of start after the World Champs. Steve then convinced me even more to play, and I practiced and this, that, and the other. And I did win the two qualifiers and then found myself at the Crucible. And of course, the rest is history. Like,
have you gone back to the Mercedes garage and told them you're not going to be working there?
I should really ring that fella.
You should. He's probably still waiting there going, oh, this Murphy fella, where is he? It's a bit late.
Hang on a minute. Yeah, no, I know. I think I actually did buy my first car from there. So
okay.
It all worked out. It all worked out.
You sold it to yourself, did you?
Yeah. Great deal. I got an amazing deal.
I bet you got good commission as well for that. I want to talk about you becoming world champion. You know, great run, beat Matthew Stevens in the final. But along the way, you beat your idol, Steve Davis, and John Higgins as well. So it's quite a real tough route to the final. What are your memories of those 17 days in Sheffield?
Although I'd won my two qualifiers and that was out of the way, the fact that this was going to be my last ever tournament as a professional was still, you know, looming large in the mirror.
Yeah.
And the fact that I'd qualified for Sheffield wasn't over. And I just sort of, I played Chris Small in the first round. That was the first match I'd ever won at the Crucible Theatre. So that was a big feather in my cap. But I then had to play Higgins in the second round and just expected to lose because I'd always lost to John Higgins. He was the one who kept, every time I got to a personal best, he slapped me down. And just a few months before, he'd beaten me 6-0 in the semis of the British Open. So I didn't hold out much hope to beat him over 25 frames at the Crucible Theatre. And when I did beat him, I think I beat him 13-9. That kind of was a bit of a wake-up call and a bit of a, well, there's now only 8 players left. You know, let's not give up. Let's see what we can do here.
At that stage, when you're beating John Higgins, are you still going to be a car salesman or is that gone now?
It was starting to go. I had this kind of marker that if I got to the semi-finals that year, I could get into it. I think it was the top 32.
Right.
And as I say, the rankings only changed once a season back then. So it was kind of a, you know, if you do win another 2 games, suddenly the season becomes a success and you've, you know, I had achieved my goal, which was to get in the 32 at the end of the year. But I still wasn't really thinking about it, mainly because, like, with respect to Steve, I did expect to beat Steve and did. But then, I only had to look a couple of names further in the draw and I could see that waiting for me in the semi-finals was probably going to be Ronnie O'Sullivan. And, you know, that was going to be very, very difficult to get past him at that stage of my career, as clueless as I was back then, which is only a little bit less clueless than I am currently. But I was even more clueless back then. And obviously he is and was, you know, the biggest name in the game. So that was going to be tough. Of course, nobody banked on Peter Ebdon beating O'Sullivan in that famous, probably infamous quarterfinal. And there's no doubt I would much rather have played Peter than Ronnie.
And then, of course, you went on to become world champion at the age of 22. Is that the pinnacle of your career for obvious reasons? But does it get any better than that, or is that it?
Do you know, it's such a strange one because, like, I follow a lot of other sports, tennis and golf mainly, and you see these young lads that come on the tour and they win a couple of sort of small events, then a sort of main tourish event, and then they might flick a major in at some stage of their career. I kind of did that the wrong way around, if you like, and it's not the way you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to, you know, build your career steadily and peak. A bit like Judd has, you know. Judd sort of did it the correct traditional way. Of course, I remember playing Judd on his debut at the Crucible Theatre and, you know, sort of remember that quite fondly. And certainly, with you look at where his career has now gone, to have been there at the start was quite special. But, like, if I'm being completely honest, I think winning the Masters in 15 and completing that Triple Crown set was a bigger moment for me.
Wow.
Because I understood what it meant. Whereas at 22, winning the world, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I didn't understand how big a deal it was. I did know that if I won, I'd be the second youngest. But I think when you're young, you don't really think about stuff. You know, you're not really taking on board that information. let everyone else talk about it. And I just sort of carried on potting the balls and going for mental shots. And luckily for me, they all went in that, for that fortnight. But yeah, I didn't really think about it. Why I've said I'd always love the, I'd love to win it again to try and sort of savour it a bit more. Now, as a, obviously as an adult and everything that goes with that, because at 22, I didn't really, you know, I didn't really savour it much. I don't remember much of it.
Sean, when you became world champion, what was it like the following season? Because, of course, it's something that you've never experienced. You're being announced into every match as champion of the world, and everyone wants to play you, and everyone wants to beat you as well. And on top of that, you've become a household name. How did you deal with all of that?
Yeah, probably pretty badly looking back at it. I certainly didn't, you know, do what Judd's done this season following his world championship win and consolidate and move forward. You know, I didn't win anything the following season. I think I got to one final, lost to Stephen Lee in the Welsh Open. And, you know, just kind of got caught up in golf days, appearances. I think I went on comic relief, you know, all this type of stuff.
Did you think you'd done it?
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly where I come from, the village I grew up in, Earthlingborough in Northamptonshire, you know, things like that just don't happen to people from those types of places. It just doesn't happen. It's things we read about. It's things we saw on TV. These people were on the news. It didn't happen to us. And didn't really know how to handle any of it. Like, you know, didn't really know what invite to say yes to and to turn down to, managers, agents, sharks, who's trying to take you, who wants to actually look after you. You know, how much should you be paying a manager? How much percentage of this, that? Should you be sponsored by this company? You know, all of this type of stuff. And meanwhile, all of those things are distracting you from what you're actually good at, the only thing you're good at, as it happened. And, you know, that sort of tells in your results. I'd love to get in a time machine and go back to that year and have a quiet word with myself and just say, listen, leave all that stuff there. It'll all take care of itself. You go back to the snooker club and practice and try to win as many of these tournaments as you can. That would have been a, I wish someone had given me that sort of talk, like, you know, but they didn't. And unfortunately, you know, for me, that's just the way that was.
We'll talk about, you mentioned just before the break about when you became Masters champion in 2015 and that sort of completed the Triple Crown. We'll talk about that in a minute because, of course, there's lots of highs in your career. But I want to talk about possibly a few lows. You got to two other world finals. In 2009, you got beat against John Higgins 18-9 quite convincingly. And in 2015... you lost to your good pal, Stuart Bingham, 18-15. Tell me a bit about both of those finals. Which one was harder to take than the other? And which one do you think you perhaps maybe had more of a chance to become world champion for the second time in?
It's funny because I remember them both quite differently. I mean, obviously, I got closer to winning in 15. I think Stuart and I were 15 all or something at one stage before he pulled away to the victory. But I think I look back with, not regrets, probably the wrong word. I look probably with more disappointment at the 09 loss to John because I didn't really feature in the match. I think we were four each after the first session. And from then on, I allowed him to run off into the distance. And he exposed the weaknesses in my, you know, safety game and defensive game and just completely dismantled me. And I think I look back at that and go, yeah, just ran out of steam there and just wasn't clever enough to compete with somebody at that level. The 15 final, I think out of the 33 frames that were played, there was like 29 or 30 breaks over 50 or 60. It was a very high standard match. And like, you know, I shook his hand and was genuinely pleased for him. You know, it was a great match of snooker. And I don't really look back at that with any regrets. I'm more disappointed about the 09 final because, as I say, these opportunities to win that tournament don't come round all the time. And I didn't really take part in that game.
That's surprising me you say that because as a snooker fan myself, when you got to the final in 2015 against Bingham, the Stuart Bingham you were playing in that final isn't the Bingham that we know and love now. Of course, he'd never been world champion, never been a ranking event winner. He was a totally different player. I had you as odds-on favourite, like by miles to win that. And I was, at the time, I wouldn't say it was one of the biggest upsets in snooker final history, in world final history. But I was really stunned that you lost it. And I'm quite surprised that it didn't hit you as hard as I thought it would have done, actually.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I was disappointed, and I was, you know, disappointed to lose. That match is the biggest match of your life if you're lucky enough to be involved in it. And I've been in three of them. please don't take what I'm saying as you know, it's just water off a duck's back, because I was desperately, desperately disappointed to lose it. And probably was favourite to win it, if there is such a thing. Sport isn't played on paper, and Stuart no. played unbelievably well all the way through that tournament. I think he beat Robbie Williams, Graham Dart, Ronnie O'Sullivan, Judd Trump, and myself. I mean, Jesus, he fully deserved it.
He deserved it. Yeah, he probably did. You talked about what was the most important moment in your career, and I thought it was going to be when you became champion of the world. But you said that it was when you became Masters champion in 2015. You absolutely tonked Neil Robertson in the final 10-2. But that, of course, meant you became, I think, one of only 10 players at the time to be a Triple Crown winner.
Mm.
And you were old enough to understand and appreciate it a bit more.
Mm.
So just tell us a bit more about that feeling. Because I think even if you hadn't won the UK and the world before it, as a snooker fan, to become Masters champion is up there with, of course, one of the best accolades you can ever achieve.
Yeah, I mean, it's big news in our sport. And probably just in sport in general. But I think living with that, the monkey on my shoulder of, you've won two of the three Triple Crowns, that's the one you need. You know, a bit like Rory McIlroy now, he needs the Masters to complete the set. And he has to every single year turn up to Augusta with that pressure. This is the one I need. You know, I'd gone to the Masters for 7 years with that pressure on my shoulder of, this is the one I need to win. It's not peak. It's not just playing well and trying to win a trophy every now and again. This is the tournament, and it's very, very hard to peak for a specific event. But somehow, by hook or by crook, you know, off the back of nothing, I think the previous event I'd lost in the UK Championships early. You know, I don't think I'd showed any form really going into that tournament.
Mm.
But all the stars aligned that week, and you know, I gave everything I had in the final. It was only a few years before I'd lost to Neil in the final there itself anyway. So I knew exactly how hard that was going to be. And I suppose that only added to the pressure, really, because I'd been to the final and squandered the chance to complete the set 3 or 4 years prior to that. So, you know, that added to it. But I think I was so pleased. I think it was Elaine's first time to a tournament that week. It was also, weirdly, it was also my mother's first time watching me play live after all those years. And I think I said during the presentation, like, you know, it isn't like this every week. And so I've been proven to be right. You know, there's the highs and lows of sport are just incredible. I think snooker probably is on its own with that.
Do you get a replica when you win the UK, the World Championship, the Masters, all the other ones? Do you keep your trophies? Where are they all?
Yeah, I've got some replicas, and they're in the club. They're on display for all the members to see in the Stevens Green Club there. And I have to say, there's a very strong snooker family there, and they're very proud of it, and they love it, and they get taken out and polished every now and again, and it's nice for them to be on display. It's not in a narcissistic way. It's lovely to look back on every time I see them.
Mm.
They're outside my practice room. Every time I see them, you're reminded of those great moments, and that spurs you on to try to, you know, prepare well for the next event. Like, you know, without trying to sound too, you know, robotic about it, it is really good to have them there, and they're important things to have, I think.
Another great event you have was in 2017, the champion of champions, you beat O'Sullivan in the final 10-8. What did that mean to win such a big competition and beat an in-form O'Sullivan in the final as well?
Yeah, I think I look back at that as a real top moment in my career, because, you know, I played well in the whole tournament, not just the final, but I played well across that. And of course, that's an event that you have to win your place in. You know, no one gets given a place in that. So it was a really good win. I think looking back at the final, I think when I got to sort of only needing one more frame, Ronnie seemed to just go on, and he just seemed to go on a mission, and everything he looked at went in for about 45 minutes to an hour. And before I knew where I was sat in my chair thinking, geez, like, you know, if he wins one more frame, we're into a decider. How have we ended up here? Because I think I was 9-4 ahead at one stage or something like that.
Yeah.
And he just played snooker from the gods for about, as I say, an hour. And in the end, I think the overriding feeling was relief, because I got a chance to steal the frame and took it and, you know, managed to take the trophy. But yeah, it was, you know, but for a shot here or there, it was a deciding frame, and who knows?
We'll talk about this season in just a moment. You had a really good season, actually. You won China, you won the Welsh Open as well, and got to another final, which we'll talk about in a moment. But going back to the 2017 Championship, so you've won that, you've played really well, you've beaten an informed O'Sullivan, and then you had this sort of barren period for a couple of years. Why is that? What do you put that down to?
Yeah, it's funny. I think I probably set my standards quite high, and for me, it's about winning. I think that season where I won the Champion of Champions, I think I got to five finals that season. And people talk about it as a barren period. But I suppose that's probably a backhanded compliment, really. Ultimately, there are a lot of players who would they give their back teeth for a season like that. But as I say, going back to how I was brought up as a child, it wasn't about finishing second and, the runners-up medal and didn't you have a great week? That just wasn't the way I was taught. And I've always said I would swap that consistency. I'd love to delete that word from the dictionary and just take the trophies. So this season, having won two ranking events in a season for me is quite big. That's quite a big development for me. Now, for a lot of players, that's standard. But for me, that's been quite a thing because the nine ranking events that I've won in my career have spanned my career. Whereas you see people like your Judd Trumps and O'Sullivan's, Hendry's, Selby's, Roberts, they're winning multiple events per season. And, just for the first time in my life, it was quite nice to step into that circle with them.
Yeah, let me ask you then, because of course, you have had a good season so far. You've not long got married to Elaine. You've moved to Ireland. You've got two wonderful children. Has all that lifestyle, has it maybe changed how you're playing on the table? Has it maybe changed how you approach the game?
I think it's changed in a lot of ways. I think I'm a lot better at dealing with defeats now than I ever was. I think because you come home to a family, certainly with the two young kids, they don't allow you the freedom of sulking and moping around for a few days. You're not allowed to do that. So it's, by the time I make the journey home and I'm here, drop the bags at the door and turn the key in the door, then you've got to be, fun daddy. So I think that's kind of helped me a bit with that. And then again, on the flip side of that coin, it spurred me on to, I'd really love to be in a position to try and give these kids things that I didn't have and a life that, wasn't afforded to me. And that means me going to work and potting more balls than the other guys. So it spurred me on to get out and get practicing even harder. As everyone back working with Chris Henry now for a good year or so. And we're really trying to, get back to where we were in 15, where we felt we were playing as good as anyone, and try and get back there and go past if we can.
Are you back to form now? And the reason I say that is, of course, because we were there. Eurosport was there when you became Welsh Open champion not too long ago this season. You beat Kyron Wilson 9-1 in the final. How do you rate that performance? Because it was breathtaking from start to finish where I was sitting.
Yeah, no, it's up there. It's definitely up there. To beat someone of his class by that scoreline. I think I even stole a couple of frames from Needing Snookers, which like that never happens.
Yeah.
Now, who am I? That was weird. But yeah, I think I played well that week and certainly played well in the final after a grueling semi-final that nearly went wrong the night before. I was up till 1 a.m.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was horrific.
He had a birthday, didn't he, Bing Tao?
Yeah, I said after the game, I don't think the match was a long game, but he did have a birthday halfway through it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was horrendous, that match. But listen, that's the way it goes sometimes. And you see the next day he came back fresher and play to a much higher level. I think that's just the way, that's what we love about snooker. It can change from day to day,
And of course, the season has obviously been cut short with what's going on in the world. I'm curious, in a minute, we're going to do top 10. So I've got 10 questions for you, but I'm curious if you like, this is number 11. If you had the choice between playing the World Championship later on in the year, but not at the Crucible, or not playing it at all because it can't be at the Crucible, what would you choose?
I think the World Championships has to be played. Where it gets played, I think, is an irrelevance at this point. I think we're at the stage where I think the players on the 64 bubble who are fighting for their tour cards, I think they deserve the right to, that they got their tour card based on a two-year ranking system that incorporates, the China Open and the World Championships, neither of which have happened yet. And I think they deserve that right to have that tournament to play for their tour spot. I think this season has to be finished before we can start talking about next season. As I say, we're talking about livelihoods, and it's very easy to just think the World Championships is only about the 32 players who are at the Crucible and the handful of players who have a chance of winning it. Unfortunately, that tournament is about a lot more than just those few players. And as I say, those players who are 64 and below, who are fighting for their position on the tour, for their opportunity to call themselves a professional player, that's more important, and they deserve the chance to play that event.
We finish, as we do with every one of my guests, with a quick top 10, a quick fire. You can answer in one or two words or elaborate as much as you want. So question number one, who's the best player you've ever played against?
Easily Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Question number two, a player you wish you could have played against, but you never got the chance.
Davis was my idol. I would have loved to have played Davis at his absolute peak when he was in his pomp in the 80s, when he was winning everything, just to see how good he was. I heard he was decent.
He was okay, but the level of opponents back in the 80s was appalling. I think I would have got in the top 16.
Not sure about that.
maybe 32 then. What's the best match you've ever played in?
Yeah, grief. I'm not sure. It's a tough one. I think even though I came second in it, I actually think the 2015 World Final was one of the best matches I've ever been a part of. I think the standard and entertainment, the show that we put on for everyone, as the blue ribbon match of the sport, is and was one of the best games I've ever been involved in. For me, it was just a shame I lost, but it was still a great game.
The best snooker venue for atmosphere is where?
The Crucible Theatre, by a mile.
I'm getting a lot of different answers from players. A couple of people said Germany. I'm getting Goths I got from Ronnie O'Sullivan. So it's interesting that everyone's got different views on that.
I just missed Goths. I think the Irish Masters was canned the year before or just as I got on the tour or something. Never actually played there. It's ironic. It's only 20 minutes up the road from where I live now.
Get a table in there. You can have a bit of a practice. There's no one about. next question. Your best ever performance at any level would be what?
I mean, I talk about the work, the winning the Masters in 15, put that marker point there. But I actually remember a match. It was in the Welsh Open against Jamie Cope. I think I had four centuries in five frames. And, that type of thing doesn't come along very often. I remember it being on one of the back tables, three or four, very few people watching. And I remember, I think I missed on sort of 80 or 90 for five tons on the spin.
Wow.
Which was, a bit silly, really.
That is amazing. How many cues have you had and which is your best one?
I had a cue. When I was, there was a local cue maker called Mac Chambers, and he cut me down a cue to size when I was 9 or 10. And he said to me, when you make your first 100 break, I'll make you a proper cue for free, which he did. So I found that was two. And then I had a cue, I had work done to that cue by another cue maker called Rodney Hind, who was in the Northants area. He was a magician with cues. And we borrowed an old Tom Newman billiard cue from his collection so I could still hit some balls whilst this work was being done. Of course, the first shot I hit with that Tom Newman borrowed cue made 143 break.
Oh, my God.
So I never went back to the old cue, and I had that cue until about 6 or 7 years ago. And I just noticed it was about 100 years old. Ray Reardon had used it at some point in his career. It had quite a good pedigree, that cue. And I just thought, before that cue damages itself anymore, I put it to one side and swapped. And John Paris made me a handful of cues, and I chose the one that I'm playing with now. So what's that, four? I think that's four.
And out of those four, have you got them all still?
I gave one to my brother. I gave one of them to a guy who helped me throughout my career. Used to come to all the events when my dad couldn't. He's got the cue that I won the World Championship with. And obviously the cue that I use is behind me here under a table. Gathering dust as we speak.
Yeah, not for much longer, I hope. Who's your toughest ever opponent?
I think the toughest opponent would probably be John Higgins, I think. As I say, I had such a torrid time with him in my early career. Every personal best I got to, he slapped me down like I was just a nobody. And then when I got that win against him in the World Championships in 05, that was a big, big moment for me. And just any match with him, you've got to scrape him off the table. He just gives absolutely everything he's got. And if you're not on your best game, you lose.
Three questions left. So question number eight, if you could change one thing in snooker, what would it be?
If I could change one thing in snooker, it would be a sort of a mixture of the misrule and then ball in hand. I think we've got to a stage now where too many players are playing that deliberate miss on a thin safety shot, and they're actually playing to miss the ball because hitting the ball too thick is too risky. I think we've moved the game into a stage now where we're actually enabling players to bend those rules and play to miss the shot, which, you know, for me sort of rubs me up the wrong way a little bit. I'd like to see a situation where any foul, a bit like the shootout, you can pick the white up and put it anywhere you like.
Wow. I mean, that changes snooker forever, doesn't it? That'd be incredible.
I think that would be great. I have to say, I think it would be better entertainment. It would put more pressure on those safety shots. As I say, it's just, I just don't like, we've ended up in a situation. I understand why the miss rule was brought in, because people were missing balls on purpose. But we've now ended up on a situation where we're back there now. Players are missing those shots on purpose, knowing they've got three attempts to hit the ball on. And it's just given everyone an opportunity to, just in my personal opinion, bend the rule a bit too much.
Question number 9, what's your biggest regret in snooker?
Gee whiz, I think my biggest regret in snooker is probably the year I was world champion and not just knuckling down and having the knowledge and experience to forget everything else, and just to, you know, focus on what got me there in the first place, practice as hard as I could, not do all of those sort of appearances and golf events that I did. I loved them all. I had a great time, but it really showed in my snooker. And I think looking back, I wish I'd just knuckled down and given everything I had to the game.
And the last question, one thing you'd still like to achieve in your career would be what, Sean?
Well, when I was a kid, you know, I set myself 3 goals. One was to be world champion. One was to own a Mercedes-Benz. And one was to be world number one. And I've achieved 2 of those things. I've never actually been number one in the rankings. Bearing in mind how far everyone else is ahead of, you know, Selby was miles ahead. He got caught. And now Trump's just like sailed off into the distance. It would be a real feat to catch them. But that was a goal I set when I was 10 years of age. And it's still something that I'm trying to achieve now.
I like, even at the age of 10, you still had something in your mind to do with the Mercedes car. Quite like that.
Yeah.
Listen, Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I know we know you as the magician, but I think you should be called the salesman. Maybe the car salesman will be a perfect nickname. I hope to see you back on the snooker circuit sooner rather than later. I'm sure we will. I'm sure this will all be over very soon. But in the meantime,
thanks
for your time. It's been a real pleasure, Sean.
Cheers. Stay safe.
There you go. The wonderful Sean Murphy. Until next time, we'll see you soon. Bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.